Welcome to the No Illusions podcast, March 2nd, 2011. My name's Cameron Riley. You're on the podcast network in the studio today, and I don't get to say that very often. Brisbane-based, well, biologist, as I understand it, also...
Physicist.
I thought it said biologist on your website.
No.
Physicist, even better. And media entrepreneur, I would have to say. The founder of skepticalscience.com. Website, iPhone app that has been a resource I've been using in climate change debates for, I don't know, probably 6 months or so. And I went onto it the other day thinking I should interview the person who put this together because it's a great resource and found out that he lives in Brisbane. John Cook, welcome, John.
G'day, Cameron.
So, John, congratulations and thank you for a start for putting it together. Yeah, you're a young looking bloke. How old are you?
39.
I'm 40. Welcome to the. when do you turn 40?
January.
Well, you know, in advance of that, welcome to the 40 Club, mate. What branch of physics do you come out of?
Astrophysics was my main area of study at uni.
Right. Astrophysics. Fabulous. Mm. Well, we can talk some about that too at some stage, I'm sure. That'd be great. What do you do now? What's your bread and butter?
I work from home with my wife. We do web design. She's a creative designer. I do all the grunt work, all the programming and database programming.
So you're a software guy as well.
Yeah.
Oh, excellent. Now, tell us about skeptical science. You're not a climate scientist, obviously.
No.
And but you launched this site when?
2007.
And why?
I actually started creating it just for myself because I was getting into arguments with family members on my wife's side, not my side. Who are all very skeptical about climate change. So I just started building a resource for myself of all the different arguments that skeptics use and then what the science said about each argument, like collecting peer-reviewed papers and research and data. And so I started building this database of all the different, all the different science. And then after a while, the database had grown to the point where I thought, well, this could be useful for other people. So I threw it online. And things just took off from there.
Threw a front end onto it.
Mm.
And you developed the iPhone app when?
Let's see now. February last year was when it was released. So I guess we started work on it in late 2009.
Excellent. And so how many, what are the stats on the site? Is it as popular as it seems to be?
On the website or on the app?
Yeah, well, both. We'll start with the website.
Well, the website gets about 500,000 visits a month.
Nice.
So, and the app, the iPhone app, the last I'd asked the developers, they said it had been downloaded about, I think, 60,000 times.
Very good.
So that was a while ago. I'm not sure what it's up to now.
So you've obviously created a resource that a lot of people are finding useful. And as I've said to you before, I use it all the time in debates. Normally when I'm on Twitter with someone and I need to quickly find, some evidence to back up my statements, I go to your site. Or people, like I was on Twitter the other day and there was some guy saying, well, what about mini ice ages? What about the mini ice age? So I can go to your site and I can look up mini ice age and find, what the hell that means for a start. And then, some of the peer-reviewed papers that back it up. So... obviously, we all know people that are still skeptical about climate change. I work with several here in the office, and we have long debates over scotch and cigars most evenings.
Is that why the other guy left the office as soon as I got here, was it?
No, it's because I told him he's too fucking noisy and he had to get out. But, yeah, he's one of them, and there's full of them, actually. They're probably all climate change skeptics here. And I find it incredibly frustrating that people are still... skeptical these days, and it seems to be a political a political viewpoint, that a particular ideology that's spread by a certain side of politics. But let me ask you, when you're in discussions with people about climate change today, how do you argue with a climate change skeptic? Do you have certain tactics or certain strategies that you follow to try and get them over the line?
I guess an important thing is just to really listen to what they're saying, and because every person is different. Like they all have their own values or they're coming at it from a certain angle. And so, you know, it might be that the basis of their skepticism is something, it could be a political thing or it could be distrust of authority or something. So I find it helpful just to find out where they're really at.
Mm-hmm.
And often when you get into a climate debate with someone, they'll often throw just a whole bunch of arguments at you in one go. And I think that's called a gish gallop. You've probably heard that phrase.
No.
Oh, okay.
How do you spell that?
Well, gish, G-I-S-H, gallop, as in a horse galloping.
Right.
It's just it's a technique when you're debating where you just throw, like, you know, a whole bunch of arguments. And to respond to that, you would have to take hours just to respond to each thing. And so usually when that happens, I find the best thing is just to not to get distracted and try to answer everything, but just pick the central theme or the most important thing that they're trying to argue.
Mm-hmm.
And just try to stay on topic and make the discussion constructive rather than just turning into a you know, like a shouting match.
What do you think is the most common cause of climate change skepticism at the moment?
I'm just speculating because you can't really read people's minds, but I think it is ideology. I think that the root of it seems to be that people don't like the idea of government intruding or controlling our lives or whatever. So, like a friend of mine, like he's not particularly political, but he said to me when I asked him why was he skeptical, he said, "I like big cars and I don't like the government telling me I can't have my big cars." You know, and that's got nothing to do with the physics of the carbon dioxide molecule. You know, that's not political. It's just basic physics. So I guess when people argue like that, I try to bring them back to just science and try to get past all the distractions of politics and all those various talking points and just get down to basic evidence and what all the evidence says.
Do you find, though, because this is what I find, that a lot of people have been misled about how science works? You know, again, I was having this argument a couple of nights ago here at the office late one night, and I was saying, you know, and I continually hear the story, well, not all scientists agree. There's still some debate on the subject. How do you respond to that?
Well, I mean, there's been a number of studies looking at this very question in climate science. And, like, there was a survey done of a whole bunch of scientists, like thousands of scientists, asking what their opinion on climate change was. And to the question of do you think humans are significantly changing climate, I think it was like about roughly 70% or something like that of scientists said yes, humans are changing climate. But what was really interesting about the survey was as you looked at the different types of scientists and their skill level regarding climate change, the more skilled they were about climate science, the more sure they were that humans were changing climate, you know, or causing global warming. So when you got up to the most, you know, the most expertise, which was scientists who were active climate scientists publishing papers about climate science, you know, over 97% of these were sure that humans were causing global warming. So you hear these surveys where they say 31,000 scientists, you know, have signed this skeptical petition or whatever, but most of those are like they would be medical doctors or engineers or people who don't actually have any expertise in climate science. And so if you're going to get, you know, if you're going to the dentist to get work on your teeth, you wouldn't get an engineer to do it. You know, you'd get someone who is an expert in that field. And the same should apply to climate science, which is just as complicated and technical as getting your teeth worked on.
So the vast majority, the overwhelming majority of climate scientists agree that global warming we're experiencing at the moment is anthropogenic. The next, challenge that I normally get from people is, oh, yes, but they have a political agenda.
Well, I mean, that's just one of those. My personal opinion is that people who say that kind of thing tend to be projecting their own kind of slant, I guess. But the evidence for climate change is based on evidence. Like it's just measurements, you know, multiple lines of measurements of all these different phenomena all pointing to the same answer. So all this evidence doesn't have a political agenda. You know, the Greenland ice sheets are not sliding into the oceans because they're Democrat or Labor. It's just basic physics, and nature is giving us a clear answer. You can't put a political spin on that.
Okay, so the next one is usually, oh, this is just natural. This happens every X number of tens of thousands of years. This is a natural cycle. Humans, it's arrogant for us to think that humans have got anything to do with it. We're just a speck in the ocean.
Well, I think it's arrogant to say that we could pollute without any consequences. And when we look at the levels of carbon dioxide in the air, it's gone up over levels, you know, that haven't been seen for millions of years. So, you know, we're significantly changing our climate. That's being directly observed. So, you know, how can you say that that's not happening? But as to whether it's natural or human caused, there's a number of like fingerprints or distinctive signatures that we can look for in the warming patterns to work out whether it's natural or human caused. And even back in the 1800s, when John Tyndall first discovered the greenhouse effect, he made all these predictions on what it should look like. He said that nights should warm faster than days if it was a greenhouse effect causing warming, and that winters should warm faster than summers. And that's what we're seeing now. Like the predictions from 150 years ago are now being borne out. And we see a whole bunch of other human fingerprints in global warming that can only be explained by greenhouse warming. And they also rule out a bunch of other effects like the sun or oceans or natural cycles.
And again, 90X percent of professional actively working and publishing climate scientists believe that humans are the major cause of what we're going through at the moment.
Yeah. A definition I like to use for skepticism is looking at all the evidence before coming to a conclusion, whereas denial is refusing to accept the evidence even when it's all presented.
Because people say, well, being skeptical is a good thing, right? You're a scientist. You always say you should be skeptical.
It is. It's completely. And every climate scientist that I've talked with are very skeptical people, because what they're doing is they spend their day, all their day, just knee-deep in all this evidence and looking at the full body of evidence. And that's... it's by considering all this evidence that they come to a conclusion. And when you look at all the evidence, like all these fingerprints and all the measurements coming in, that's the reason why there's such a consensus of scientists, because there's a consensus of evidence.
But people again will say, but there's still debate. There's still debate, and I try and explain, yes, but that's a great thing about science. There's always debate, there's always different viewpoints, but science works via consensus. If the majority of scientists active in the field review the evidence, you know, and agree with a certain interpretation of the evidence, then we decide, then there's agreement in the scientific community that this is the currently accepted theory. I mean, it has to work that way. We can't sit around and wait until we have 100% agreement on something, or, you know, I mean, it just won't happen in science, right? There's always somebody who's going to be on the fringe with a different interpretation.
It's also, that's not how science works. Like, science isn't yes or no. It's science is reducing uncertainty. And in climate science, there are certain areas that we have high understanding and other areas where we're still, you know, trying to figure it out a bit. So we have a strong understanding of the greenhouse effect and the warming that carbon dioxide causes. Like theoretically, we can work it out quite accurately, and we can measure the direct warming from CO2, and it all matches. So we know that with a high accuracy. Whereas there are other areas with less understanding, such as the aerosol effect from, you know, like sulfate pollution from coal plants. Areas that scientists are trying to nail down exactly the effect it has in terms of how it affects clouds and how it has a cooling effect by reflecting sunlight. But these areas of less understanding don't cancel out the fact that we have a high understanding of carbon dioxide. So we know enough to act. And if we were waiting for 100% certainty, we would never act, because in science that never actually happens. Probably an analogy would be with gravity. Like, we have a, we know gravity with a fairly high understanding, but there are still little areas of gravity theory that, that scientists are still, you know, arguing about exactly how it works. But because the scientists haven't got 100% certainty, it doesn't mean you jump off a cliff, you know, because there's uncertainty and therefore, you know, maybe they're all wrong or something. And it's the same with climate change. We know generally what's going to happen if we keep putting all these greenhouse gases up in the atmosphere.
Well, the analogy that I use, because a lot of these people I end up in debates with consider themselves to be rational business people, is I talk about a board of directors for a company. You know, you're going to decide what direction you should move in as a company. You put it to a vote at the board. Not everyone's going to agree, but you get a majority, you get a consensus, and that's the consensus may be wrong, but these are smart, intelligent people that are professionals in their field. They look at all of the evidence, they make a decision, there's a consensus, and you move in that direction. You don't wait until you've got 100% agreement on the board. It's sort of the same in the scientific community. You know, you look at the evidence, you make a decision on what you think that means, and when you get a consensus, we have to move. Mm. Listen, I went on Twitter this morning and just asked if anyone had any questions. Cameron Colley, my good friend, another Brisbane boy. Do you know Cameron? Founder of Drinkle.com. Wants to know what percentage of climate change is attributed to humans.
Okay, that's a good question. One estimate I read that came from Gavin Schmidt from NASA was the amount of warming from humans, and I was talking about a range. Are you going to tweet this right now?
No, I'm just going to ask him if there's any more questions. You keep talking while you're not supposed to. You're destroying the magic of behind the scenes here while I'm tweeting while you're talking. Keep going.
So Gavin said that the human influence on warming is between 90 to 110%. So there is a bit of uncertainty because of that aerosol effect that I was talking about. But we know it's between 90 to 110%, the amount of warming that we're causing through greenhouse gases.
That humans are responsible for?
Yes.
So the amount of warming, by that you mean the amount of... So there's a certain amount of warming happening. You're saying that the percentage of the warming that is happening... 90 to 120%. 110% is caused by humans.
Yes.
So all of it, basically.
Yes.
More or less.
Think of it, I guess.
How do you get 110% of it caused by humans?
Think of it as a bank balance, right? You've got the human influence, so that you add that in, then you've got the sun, which might add a little bit, but then if the sun's going down, which it currently is, then that actually adds a cooling influence. Then you've got other effects like the change in the Earth's orbit, which offers a very slight cooling effect, and there's volcanoes, which also have a cooling effect. So there's a range of other effects, and when you add all these up, just imagine if it was up to 110% from human influence, and then nature had a 10% cooling effect, and that gets us, that balances the bank balance, so to speak. So if we took out all, like, just imagine humans weren't here right now, what climate would be doing would be slightly cooling. Like, over the last, few thousand years, generally climate has been going downwards, and now suddenly it's just spiked upwards from all the greenhouse gases.
And this is an argument I heard the other day on Twitter too, saying, well, it's a good thing that we're causing global warming, because if it wasn't, we'd be going through a mini ice age. So it's yay for us for keeping temperatures up.
Well, whether global warming is a good thing or a bad thing, you just have to look at all the different effects. So in some regions, like Greenland, apparently are quite happy about global warming because it's opening up areas where they can have more agriculture from all the melting.
Does it stop the vampires?
What vampires?
Oh, vampires come, they have these, 3 months of night in Greenland, 30 days of night, vampires come in, it's a terrible thing.
Well, there's still the amount of sunlight, I think.
Really?
Yeah. That hasn't
so it doesn't
changed.
Help with the vampire problem in
Greenland.
No, okay.
I don't think so.
Right.
No, you've lost my train of thought.
Sorry, I do that.
So that's a positive thing. But in tropical areas, the agriculture is, they're exposed to drought now. And drought is actually reducing Africa's agricultural output. So when you add up all the positives and all the negatives... The negatives far outweigh all the positives, and when you add up drought and extreme weather, which we know about here in Australia, which is getting more happening more often. Yeah, there's a lot. The costs of climate change are going to be quite strong.
I know. I read the other day that our chief scientist, Penny
Sackett,
resigned. I've got the news story here. I'm opening up. Now, she was like halfway through her term, and this is on your website. Oh, Skeptical Science. Have you ever seen this? It's a good sign.
Yeah, I did read that.
Professor Penny Sackett, the articulate and charming Nebraskan who came to be Australia's chief scientist, resigned last week, smack bang in the middle of her five-year term. Although she was reluctant to discuss the reasons publicly, she was emphatic that the decision was hers and hers alone. Now, I read somewhere that she said that in her 2.5 years as chief scientist, she met Kevin Rudd once and Gillard not at all.
Mm.
What's going on when the prime ministers of the last two prime ministers of the country aren't sitting down with the chief scientist? What's going on there? What do you think?
I don't know. There seems to be a reluctance among politicians to listen to the science, because the science is giving us a very clear message, but it's a message I think most people don't want to hear, that we need to act. But to their credit, they are, you know, putting their neck on the line and trying to put a price on carbon now. So
there were some suggestions, though, I read, that the timing of Gillard's carbon price announcement was to coincide with Sackett's resignation to try and push that out of the news. What do you think?
I'm not really that political, so I couldn't. That does sound a bit conspiracy theory to me. I mean, that's such a big announcement.
But it was a big announcement with no details. It was like not like that they'd been working on it for a long time. They were just like, yeah, we're going to do a carbon price. Yeah, we don't know anything right now, but we will get back to you on that. I mean, Kevin Rudd obviously had Ross Garnaut, I think even before he was prime minister, do a massive report on what Australia should do with regards to reducing our carbon emissions. And when Rudd became prime minister, that went in the shredder and they totally ignored it.
Yeah. The thing I like about our current situation now is it's not just the Labor Party dictating where we go. We've got several independents and the Greens, and they're basically accountable to these different parties for every decision they make. So that fact probably would make me think it probably wasn't to do with Sackett, because it's a joint effort now. So
and I doubt it would have even got up as far as it has without, you know, Labor having to share power with the Greens and the Independents, because they've, you know, I don't think the ALP is really that committed to any sort of a climate change program.
No, we've got a fairly strong democracy at the moment with all these different parties, you know, shaping the direction.
Tony Abbott would disagree with you on that. He doesn't think they've got any mandate, but I agree with you. I think it's a positive thing.
I mean, ideally, if they were invited to be part of this climate change committee, it would be good to have a Liberal member in there, you know, having a say, but they refused to even join it, so
yes,
that's a shame.
Well, and that says a lot about the ideology behind their position on these sorts of things. And as I say to my friends here, you know, the coalition was in power federally for 11 years and denied for most of that time that climate change was even real. When it looked like they might lose an election over it, so Howard suddenly got on board and accepted that it was a reality, but they did nothing. I mean, they completely stuck their head in the sand. Then they had Turnbull as the leader, who took it seriously, and they got rid of him. Mm. So the coalition's credibility on the issue, from my perspective, is way below zero.
I saw an interview with Howard after he'd he was no longer a prime minister.
Is this some Q&A when he did his big Q&A thing?
No, it was a
anyway.
It was a documentary about the Howard years.
Okay, right, yep.
And in there, he said, well, he thought that it was probably exaggerated climate change anyway. So once he was out of office, I think he was a denier for a while. Then he kind of towed the more politically correct line, saying that humans are causing climate change. But once he was out of office, he went back to saying, nah, I don't really believe it.
Mm.
And Tony Abbott is the same. Like, just before the election, he said, it's been cooling for the last few years. So it's a case of, you know, it's one thing to have different opinions about how to act on climate change, you know, what's the best economic and political solution. But to deny the basic science, which is what these leaders are doing, is just a pretty sad state of affairs. I kind of miss the days of Malcolm Turnbull. I wouldn't mind him back as the opposition leader. At least he'd listened to the science.
Yeah, and that's basically what I want to say to these politicians at the time, is just shut the fuck up. I don't care what you think. I don't care what your opinion is. We have a chief scientist. Go to the chief scientist and ask the chief scientist what the science says. Mm. I don't give, you know, 2 cents for what your particular opinion is, what you think is good, bad, or indifferent. Go to what the scientists say,
as well as what the Bureau of Meteorology is saying, and what the CSIRO is saying, and every scientific expert who's studying climate science in Australia.
What's the point of having a chief scientist if, you know, the Prime Minister and Parliament isn't listening to what they're saying about the science? It's drives me insane.
Mm.
So let's get back to the site. You know, we probably haven't spent enough time talking about the site and how it works. So one of the great things I like about your site is you've been able to encapsulate most of the arguments that the climate change skeptics use. But then you drill down into, or you have, there's like a beginner's version and an intermediate version in terms of the responses for the skeptics. The beginner's version, you have some high-level arguments to use. The intermediate version, you actually have source notes in there. You link through to all of the scientific papers for all of this kind of stuff. You want to talk about how you think people can use the site to help them in these sorts of debates?
Yeah, that actually began originally when I wrote the site. Was all pretty much an intermediate level. I was just writing at a level that I was comfortable with, trying to make it understandable, but I probably could have tried harder. It was fairly technical, and when I got friends of mine who didn't have a science background to read it, they said it was a bit above their level. So then Michael Ashley, who's an astrophysicist from New South Wales, he said, why don't you do these 3 levels, a basic, intermediate, and an advanced level? And I thought, oh, that's a hell of a lot of work. I'm not going to do that. But the more I thought about it just seemed like such a good idea. Because the problem with writing for science is there's so many different audiences that will read it. There's no way to write at a level that will hit all the different levels. If you write simply, you get accused of oversimplifying, and you can take difficult concepts and, you know, simplify them too much so that people can accuse you of being misleading. But then if you write too technical, it just goes over the head of the average person, and you don't do any good there either.
And do you think this is part of the problem with this whole issue? I mean, the general level of general knowledge in Australia about how science works and what and the scientific method, I find to be extremely low. You know, I continually get in debates with people, you know, when I'm trying to debunk the latest mysticism that they're into, Eakin power bands or something like that. And, you know, I'll refer to science and they say, well, science changes its mind all the time. Science doesn't know anything. One year they say this is right. 10 years later they say, oh, that was wrong, this is right. Science doesn't know anything. You can't listen to science. And I just have to facepalm and say, well, that's what makes science great. That's not a flaw. That's, you know, it's always learning. It's always revising. But do you find that the level of scientific communication in the mainstream media is extremely poor in this country, that we're not communicating what the scientific community knows effectively enough to the general public?
I think the problem with the way the mainstream media talks about science is they probably don't have the resources to fully research and understand scientific issues. So that if a journalist is given material from a skeptical scientist, you know, they'll just throw that out without critical analysis, or they're, they'll just do the both sides of the argument thing, where there's an issue to do with climate change. They'll give what, you know, a climate scientist says, but then they'll just pick out a skeptical scientist to provide this balance. But what it's saying is it gives this impression that there's this 50-50.
That it's an equal argument, yeah, exactly.
Whereas actually like a 97-3 balance.
Mm.
So, but and then that's there's this, when you look at public opinion about climate change, what you see is public opinion is about 50-50. The media portray it about 50-50, but the actual state of the science is 97-3.
Mm.
So mainstream media is that broken link between the science and the people, and they need to more properly portray how things are in the scientific community.
Why do you think they don't do that already?
Probably because journalists, maybe they just don't have the resources. Like, because journalism is shrinking as a field, like they just don't. There's less time. Journalists are more rushed to get articles out, and they don't have time to spend properly researching subjects. I mean, that's just one. I'm sure there's lots of complicated reasons.
Do you think perhaps because, you know, mainstream media is owned by big corporations, has anything to do with it?
I mean, some
corporate agenda.
Some newspapers, yes. I mean, with The Australian, they don't even give that 50-50 balance. It's all very, very, you know, skewed towards the skeptic side.
Mm.
And even when they do portray, they did one article where this guy portrayed, you know, the science as it was. The Australian very quickly provided rebuttals on that. The actual with that article to make sure that it wasn't left unchallenged.
And then we had the Ausgate issue a couple of months ago, where one of their former climate change journalists got up in a panel and talked about how she was told to rewrite stuff according to the corporate agenda, and then they tried to sue Julie Posetti over tweeting the fact that the woman said this, and you know, it was a complete debacle. So when people go to your site, they can search on arguments. I mean, when I go to your site, somebody says, well, it's a mini ice age. I can type in mini ice age and find stuff. The iPhone app, do you want to talk about the iPhone app? It's basically the same thing but sort of a simplified interface.
Yeah. How that happened was, my website had this whole searchable database of skeptic arguments and then rebuttals to them.
Yeah.
And so late 2009, this software company from Melbourne, so another Australian creation.
Want to give them a plug? Who was it?
Shine Technologies.
Shine.
I think it's shinetech.com.au.
Uh-huh.
The link will be on my site anyway. If you click on the iPhone app on my site,
There's
a link to them.
Yep.
And the two owners there, they were just very passionate about climate change, and they offered to create this app for free, and we distribute it for free so anyone could download it. And just basically taking the database of my site of all the different arguments and all the different rebuttals and just making it accessible via a sexy iPhone app interface.
And it's absolutely great. You can sit there in arguments with people at a bar, and they'll give you their skeptical argument, and you can pull up all of the data that you need to, refute them. Another question off of Twitter from Phil Kingham. He wants to know when we can expect the apes to take over the Earth.
Yeah, well, the apes are probably going to be struggling with climate change too, so I don't think there was any global warming in Planet of the Apes, was it?
I would say that we are primates, and so the apes have already taken over the Earth, so you're too late, Phil. Although maybe bacteria really rule the Earth. Well, I think that's probably enough. I wanted to get you on, John, to plug your site and get more people to go and use it as a resource. And also, we can perhaps get some of the skeptics themselves to the deniers themselves to listen to this and rethink some of their positions. You're a Brisbane boy. Did you think the floods that we had here were a result of climate change?
Yeah, that's a complicated question because, climate scientists always say that you can't attribute climate change to a single weather event.
It's more complex than that.
Yeah, but the proper question to ask is, does global warming affect extreme weather? And the answer to that is yes, because over the last 50 years, we've observed that the amount of water vapor in the atmosphere has increased because as it gets warmer, you get more evaporation. And the atmosphere is able to hold more water. So over the last 40 years, the amount water vapor has gone up about 4%, which is equivalent to about 900 Sydney harbours. So that's how much water's up in the air. And therefore it follows that if there's more water vapor in the air, there's more likelihood of getting extreme rainfall. And we've also seen the amount of extreme rainfall increasing over the last 40 years. So I don't think the science has got to the point where we could say global warming, you know, is 80% of the cause of this, the Brisbane flood. We're not quite there yet. But what we can say is that global warming has increased the odds of these kind of events happening. So we're going to have floods like this more and more often, and therefore the costs, you know, the astounding costs that the Brisbane flood caused are going to increase. And that's really the really key point about this whole argument about carbon tax, they're saying it's going to cost us now. The cost of acting on climate change now is minuscule compared to the costs that we're going to have to pay down the track.
Although the argument, and this is a common argument I've heard in the last week from people, is that, well, you know, but we're like, Australia's 1.28% of global carbon emissions. Doesn't matter what we do. What we do is not going to have any effect anyway. So why bother? Unless the entire world's going to do it, why should we do it?
Well, a number of countries have already implemented a carbon tax. But that argument is like saying, well, if I just throw my garbage out on the street, that's just a little bit. But if everyone thought that, then you know, we'd have garbage all over our street. So countries are all getting in line. There's a lot of action all over the world towards putting in carbon taxes. And I think Australia, if we'd done it before Copenhagen, which was what the plan was, I think that would have had a big influence on other countries and the negotiations at Copenhagen. So
we have a little bit of ethical leadership that we could take. And you know, one of the arguments I use is, well, you know, it's often said that Australians are the biggest emitters of carbon per capita in the world. So we have an ethical and moral responsibility to clean up our own backyard before we can stand around and tell other countries to clean up theirs. And secondly, we are one of the wealthiest countries per capita in the world, and we've profited a great deal over the last century from advanced industry, from mining shit out of the ground. We've profited the most from carbon emissions in the 20th century, and one of the countries that has profited the most in the world. You know, we have benefited the most from emitting carbon into the atmosphere, and we're one of the largest emitters of carbon per capita. It just seems to me to be an ethical and moral imperative that we're also one of the first to change our ways to do something about it. But people will say to me, oh, but it's not fair if everyone else doesn't do it. Well, it's not about fair, it's about what's right.
I think it's also what's right and what's smart, because people think that putting a price on carbon is going to ruin the economy or anything. But what we're actually doing is transitioning our economy and our lifestyle to a better way of doing things. And it's a small, like it's a small price now, but in the long term, it actually will lead to lower prices for power by switching to renewable energy. An example is just in our own household. We paid a bit of money now to get solar power, and that had an upfront cost for us. But in the long term, we're going to save heaps, especially as, you know, inevitably electricity prices go up, and we've insulated ourselves against that. And as a country, we can insulate ourselves from the rising price of fossil fuels by switching to renewable energy. And Australia, where we've got a whole coastline where we can take advantage of wind and wave power.
And the rest of the country is a fucking desert.
Yeah, where we can take advantage of solar power.
You know, solar and hot rocks and all sorts of stuff we can do out in the world. And, you know, this is the thing. We have an opportunity to be a world leader in developing alternative energy sources and actually ride the next big economic boom, which is going to come out of green energy. And this is the crazy thing. The side of politics that is the pro-business, pro-capitalist, innovation side of politics, supposedly the Liberal coalition, the Nationals in this country, are the ones that are sticking their head in the sand rather than embracing the opportunity that this move towards green seems to present for business. They're the ones that are going, no, we don't want to know about it, it doesn't exist, blah, I got my fingers in my ears, you know, it's you would think they'd be the guys that would be jumping on board and talking about big vision and big innovation and the opportunity for big business in Australia and the amount of jobs that could be created and all of this kind of stuff. But they're doing the opposite of what their political ideology supposedly is on paper.
Mm. Also, they had an opportunity to implement a market-based way to reduce carbon emissions. And because they rejected that, now we're going with a carbon tax, which would seem to be against their particular way of doing things.
Although Gillard has said that it's within 3 years, I think it's going to move towards a market-based mechanism. I mean, they're still, you know, saying, no, we're going to fight it, we don't want it. It's, you know, it's all, I don't know,
I think
smells.
I heard someone say when it comes to climate change, smart people can say some really dumb things. And the thinking gets very muddied as soon as this issue is. Like, there's a lot of science issues where smart people, you know, can say smart things, but suddenly this issue, the ideology comes in and clouds people's thinking.
Mm.
And that seems to be the case with Howard, with Abbott, where they can't even accept the science.
Mm. Well, John, thank you so much for coming into the studio as it is, the factory studio. And for chatting, and once again, congratulations and thanks for taking the time. I know what it's like to invest, you know, a lot of your time into building something as a resource for people, and you deserve commendation, sir. I hope it continues to do well.
Thanks for inviting me, and good to actually talk to someone face-to-face for a change.
Skeptical, yeah, it is for me too. Skepticalscience.com, yeah?
Mm.
Yeah, okay. And on Twitter, you're just Skeptics. Science. Skeptic Science.
They have this limit. I couldn't fit that AL in there because of their character limit.
So it's Skeptic Science?
Yes.
Skeptic Science on Twitter. Thanks, John.
No worries.